Welcome to this very, yet another strange and sad day.
Could be something the last 5 minutes.
That's right.
I mean, there is.
It's perfect for our subject matter, of course, which is completion of the second commitment. And our subject is a catalyst for compassion. So there it is. Mm. I thought we might begin by reading the Bodhisattva Vow together. Mm-hmm. Thanks. And everybody should have a copy.
Once I hand it to them, they will.
Yeah, and everybody will read a stanza and we'll just go around till it's finished. Because I think that's, although not everyone, I don't know that everyone here has taken that vow. We're all working with, this is a material we're working with, and this is the energy we are working with as practitioners. This is the view. Fundamentally, whether you've taken the vow or not. You're going to take this because I printed one for myself. So I'll just use that one. See, I'm so greedy. And this will help sort of land us in the spot for how we can continue to talk about this material with our broken hearts that nevertheless are not closed for business. So we'll each take a stanza and go around.
As earth and the other elements, together with space, eternally provide sustenance in many ways for countless sentient beings,
so may I become sustenance in every way for sentient beings to the limits of space until all have attained nirvana.
As the Sukhitas of old gave birth to the bodhicitta and progressively established themselves in the training of a bodhisattva,
so I too, for the benefit of beings, shall give birth to the bodhicitta and progressively train myself in that discipline.
At this moment, my birth has become fruitful. I have realized my human life. Today, I am born into the family of the Buddhas. Now, I am a child of the Buddhas.
From now on, I will forthrightly perform the actions befitting my family. I will act so as not to degrade the faultlessness and discipline of my family.
Just as with a blind man finding a jewel in a heap of dust, thus somehow bodhicitta has been born in me.
This is the supreme amrita which destroys death, the inexhaustible treasure which removes the world's poverty.
It is the supreme medicine which cures the world's sickness, the tree which provides rest for beings weary of wandering on the paths of existence.
It is the universal bridge on which all travelers may pass over the lower realms, the rising moon of mind which dispels the torment of the kleshas.
It is the great sun which puts an end to the obscurity of ignorance, the pure butter which comes of churning the milk of the holy Dharma.
For travelers wandering the paths of existence, seeking happiness from objects of enjoyment, it is the supreme bliss near at hand, the great feast which satisfies sentient beings.
Today, witnessed by all the protectors, I have welcomed sentient beings and Sukhitas. Devas and Asuras, rejoice.
Mm-hmm. There's so much in this vow, and this class is not particularly intended to discuss this vow in full. But it seemed particularly appropriate to for each of us to have copies of it and to relate with it. I want to point out that twice is mentioned progressively establishing oneself in the training of a bodhisattva. Progressively train myself in that discipline. So we are not the first people to begin thinking, to begin at the beginning, knowing all of our faults and all of our limitations and all of our confusions and all the moments in which we fail ourselves, not to mention others. We begin there and we progressively work with ourselves and the path. And we, over time, become more and more used to being the bodhisattva, the warrior who can not flinch from ugliness, not hide out from things that are fearful. That we have a discipline to look at ourselves with compassion and the world with compassion, even in its ugliness. It's progressive. It's really important to remember, because our tendency to be cruel to ourselves and diminish ourselves and disappoint ourselves again and again, it's time we stopped wasting that time. Because this world is desperate for us to hold our seats and to understand and to witness and be of benefit where we can. Nothing like today, the accumulation of the past, the disasters, the endless murders, and as you can see, profoundly affected me. We can't lose heart. And that we've acknowledged that other people suffer is an astonishingly beautiful place to begin. It's hopeful. And that's what we've committed to, among other things, which we will, of course, get to, but not to shut down, not to surrender to the desire to hide out. And I am one of these people who would, if I could, would be really happy to watch Netflix all day, mm-hmm. as our friend last night, a friend of ours last night was saying, or some stupid crap, just to ignore this, my own sadness and fear, and the world's sadness and fear. So begin where we are, again and again, with kindness to ourselves, and bravery to look things straight in the eye. Anyway, does that make sense? That's what we're working with. So today, 13 dead in a mass shooting. We was it a week ago? Was it only a week and 2 weeks ago? Week and a half?
A little less than two weeks ago.
Yeah. That shooting in Pittsburgh.
Saturday. It was a Saturday, so.
So here it is, a vivid catalyst for compassion. And the hard part, it's not just for the injured, it's for the perpetrators as well. How can we have a vast enough mind to include them in our compassion? It's a progressive path. We could say that's how. So this aspiration is to care for all beings everywhere. As we say again and again, not just people we like. All beings, and this is an impossible aspiration. It's an impossible commitment.
So that, like when several of us took the Bodhisattva vow with Meet Your Mark, and he gave this beautiful talk, which I'm sorry we didn't record.
I know.
What he said that really stuck with me, he said another way, an easier way to think about it, which is in some ways harder, is that means you can't leave anyone behind.
Right.
And when he said that, I like had a vision of exactly who I wish loved to have been. Like, if I can't do everybody, I can leave that person off. Since I couldn't do everybody, I'll leave that person off. And he said, that's really the place, and it's... He had another poem that was similar to the poem this guy's had, but it was about a turtle in the road.
Right.
It wasn't frogs. It was a turtle in the road.
Right.
And it was about, you know, stopping and moving the turtle. And he said, that's it. Wow. It's that, like, the nuisance of stopping to move the turtle, because you're not leaving anyone behind, even some turtle that was foolish enough to walk.
I must interject.
Go ahead.
But when I was quite young, maybe 11, I found a turtle in the road, and I picked it up, and I carried it away, and the damn thing bit me.
Oh!
Was it a big snapper?
It must have been.
Yeah.
I mean, but nevertheless,
there
it was.
You junior bodhisattva. Girl bodhisattva.
Girl bodhisattva.
Wow.
Right.
And you would have done it even if you'd known that.
Yes,
you would have.
Well, somehow I... Who knows?
Or you watch the turtle bite somebody else and then you help it.
Hmm?
Or you watch the turtle bite somebody else and then you help it.
Yeah, right. No, see? I wasn't that much of a bodhisattva kid, I guess. So
that's a progression. You start somewhere.
You've got it exactly. I suppose if we all looked at our lives in the past, we might all see harbingers of our own heart opening up, even when we were little. I mean, I certainly can see that in my life, that we didn't just land here. Because one day we thought, you know, I'm gonna not be crazy and help people. There's their seed. Yes.
So I remember at family camp at Karma Chuling, my son instituted his own program. He saw that there were snakes, and he wasn't upset about the snakes at all. But he saw that there were frogs which could become victims of the snakes. So he carefully started his own program of relocating the frogs. One after another, he kept up moving the frogs without in any way interfering with the snakes, and he just kept doing this.
And that's an endless task, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like our job here.
Right. Endless frogs. Endless frogs.
There's the outcome.
I mean, the stories of the Buddha, you get the same happiness, like in lifetimes, you know, how he had given his he gave himself to a hungry tigress, and you know, so like, didn't it was progression.
Yes, and I've read those and thinking like, are you kidding me? Yeah. I'm gonna cut off my arm because that poor tigress is hungry. Well, I haven't progressed that far along. But those stories...
But it's a story of progression.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So, maybe you're all aware of this, so there's been, regarding the synagogue shooting, we can have a... So there's been this story...
Regarding the...
The synagogue shooting.
Yes.
So there's a story that's been going on the internet, and it's basically about the Jewish nurse. Do you know that story?
Yeah.
So, anyway, all you have to do is Google the Jewish nurse. So, first...
Oh, I did.
So when the shooter... He's still alive, but he's in bad condition. He was rushed to a hospital, he was still conscious of, he's screaming death to the Jews, Hitler was right, etc. The first three medical people who treated him were Jews.
Yeah.
And there's this one guy, I don't know how old he is, but it turns out my rabbi knew him when he was a teenager or preteen. He was like this really nice soul even then. So he's a nurse, an RN. And he finally wrote a story, or his own essay, about his treating this guy. And he knew, this guy would have killed him in a second, and yet the ultimate compassion, because he was trained as a nurse, right, to just just to not see beyond caring for everybody and like making sure his next breath was, etc. But so, to me, that was an ultimate compassionate thing. But what it also brought to me is that training is important, and that we're all being trained.
Yes.
And he was trained as a nurse, and that training meant you treat everybody, you don't think about anything other than helping them. And we're being trained. It takes training. We're being trained.
That's right.
Not in medicine, but so.
That's what they call it, practice.
Compassion.
Right.
Trained.
Yeah.
Compassion.
Yeah. He talked a lot about compassion also. He's sort of an old soul. I don't think he's very old. I think he's maybe 30 at the most or something. But his own trials, there was a lot of anti-Semitism when he was growing up in Pittsburgh, whatever. But it was very interesting, the training part. Yeah.
Actually, I think I saw the head of that hospital interviewed, making a comment about, as a Jew, that he noted that he was helping this person, and how, what a peculiar juxtaposition that was, and yet that's their responsibility.
It happens all the time in Israel.
I understand.
This,
I know this.
But the Israeli soldiers or not so doctors are treating terrorists, and vice versa, I think. But anyway. But those don't make the stories.
No. Like kind of an everyday event.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, we get this right now. I mean, I'm in a very heightened state of, it's sort of like I'm... hyper tuned into suffering or something like that. Maybe that's because of this, all these events, but mostly it seems like, I'm okay. I'm hanging out, taking care of business, gotta go to Marshall's, gotta go grocery shopping, blah, blah, blah. I'm okay. And there's a real sense of, it isn't like, cruel, but there's a sense of I'm fine, right? But we do we're not always so fine. I mean, we're actually not all fine. We've got various aches and pains and sorrows and so on. And these are the things that the baby Bodhisattva, or shall we say, Bodhisattva in training, uses to make a connection with other people's suffering. I feel like we've already been working with this a lot, but if you might remember, maybe there was a time when you didn't plug into somebody else's suffering. You made a decision to ignore the person begging for money, or you just othered that person. Well, this training that we're doing makes us very, any suffering we have can become used as a path to understand this vaster world of people who are experiencing the same thing you are. So, for example, in Tonglen, we think of something very difficult that's going on in our lives, and we think, we breathe that in, and we breathe in that everybody who is feeling this at this moment, the same thing that I am, may they be relieved. So we've already opened a connection with this whole vast world, and we are more and more planting the seed of that manifesting in our, the way we live, actually, the way we actually behave. We include our own confusion. We recognize our confusion. We recognize that if we are feeling this, how many other people right now, at this very minute, are feeling confused or hurt or terrified or whatever it is. So we do this over and over and over again, and that's our training. Every time we judge ourselves and we're cruel to ourselves, take note of it, acknowledge it, and start again with the aspiration, all the people in the world who are doing that, just like me, may they also be free of this. So it is a progression. And Pema in the book emphasizes not running away from groundlessness. Right now, where I feel sitting right here, edginess, fundamental uneasiness or dis-ease, not shutting down because of fear. Every time I teach, I have a little fear before I begin. I feel sort of, am I doing this properly? Am I benefiting? Right? Benefiting others. You know, so it's even on a very subtle level. That's our connection. That's the warrior's path to acknowledge that and to open. Acknowledge and leap. That's one of the things it means for me to not surrender or not close up. I mean, I assume we each have our own ways that we, how do we not shut down? How do we not hide from our panic or surrender to the panic? That's actually a quest.
Well, one of the things I was thinking a lot about is that it seems to me that whenever there's anything that we're afraid of, the more we turn away from it, the bigger the fear gets.
Yeah.
Because it just does. And that so one incentive to go toward it is that it just, in many cases, I mean, obviously an oncoming train or something, something that you really should avoid, but you're afraid of interacting with someone because of whatever reason. Usually, I think, if you approach that person with some kind of, well, with an open heart,
openness,
then there's less of that back and forth dynamic where they, you know, like you're not contributing to the negativity, which then they can punch back at.
So you don't have a territory to defend.
Something like that. So, yeah, it can go. I had that experience like the past. So a couple of weeks ago, it's not even that long ago, when I was sitting shiva, and I was more open than usual because of my
heart
situation, grief, and just everything being different. And there, it was quite remarkable. I mean, there are people that, as you said, you know, these kindnesses that I wouldn't have even expected to show up or say things, but there are other people that I had certain images of, but I needed the closeness, and suddenly, you know, I wasn't expecting, you know, I'm sure that my look on my face was different, so I wasn't expecting meanness. I was like just looking really probably accepting, and then that generated that. So whenever we can, if we can go toward it, it seems to have a good result.
It's meaningful.
Personal experience, yeah. Yes. I mean, unfortunately, or maybe just how it is, sometimes it has to be a crisis in order to do that. Maybe that's a trick to do it when there's not a crisis. Well, you know what? It's a crisis.
It's funny, at work, I was trying to get some work done near my office, and I heard these other teachers talking, and they were having a conversation about having to call parents with bad news about a kid who's not doing well. And like they were having to pep talk one woman, like, you have to make the call, you have to make the call. And then like 2 minutes later, she goes, it went really well. Like, it was okay.
Yeah.
And it was such an encapsulation of that. Like, when you dread something and you make this story, all the different horrible ways this could turn out.
Yeah.
The parent could yell at me, she could do this, she could do that, And it's that, like, you create those stories of all the horrible ways this could go. And it might go one of them, but it's probably not going to go all of the horrible ways you may come. You know, it's probably one. And it might be none of them.
Isn't that interesting? Because that's sort of like sitting on the cushion, thinking or following.
Well, that's
we do that in life.
We do that in life all the time. What's going to happen if I do this? Oh my God! And there are 50 different ways it could go south, but there's also like probably 100 ways it could go fine.
I've had so many experiences though where I worry about the wrong thing, and there was something entirely different to worry, or something that really didn't happen. I mean, because we really can't figure out, we really don't know all the possibilities. So you might as well not, easier said than done, worry about them. But it happens all the time.
Anybody else have any?
There was some friends who were in hot conditions the past couple of weeks, and they were convinced, you know, the bottom was going to fall out.
The what?
The bottom was going to fall out. They were going to end up on the streets, you know, literally on the streets, mother, son, and daughter. And everything was falling apart, and so they stayed with me in one way or another. And they just kept talking about how they convinced something was going to happen. This is the way it's going to go. I know. Everything sucks, and these people don't give a shit and all this stuff. They were convinced. And each time I was with maybe one alone, each one would say sort of the same verbiage that their relative would say, you know, their blood. So it turned out different. It turned out different. And I was just saying, you don't know how it's going to do. And it was good for me because I was getting hit from all sides. And I honestly felt we could not expect what really was going to happen. You know, you just don't know. But it's true, you could get blindsided by one of these things they were convinced was going to happen. It was the only possibility, set of possibilities in their mind. So, one of them had to happen. And that's completely false. So they found an apartment for the three of them. And I took off. I was gone for a couple of weeks.
Uh-huh.
And it was sayonara. So I came back last night, and I haven't gone near them in the apartment.
You replaced that to yourself.
If it was snowing out, they would be throwing more than snowballs at each other. In other words, they were very harsh with each other. But it was just remarkable to see that something out of the blue happened. And it was they had no idea. And I had no idea.
That's great.
I think, if I could just say what the Bodhisattva vow to me, never made sense to me. Because it sounded as if it was real, but to me it was always motivational.
Aspirational.
Aspirational. Yeah. That is, if that's what aspiration means. I didn't know really if that was an actual intent or if it was motivational. But I said, this could be nothing but motivation. You can't achieve the impossible. And I used to think of a mathematical line. I remember as a kid, they'd say, what's the largest number? And of course, I was trying to think of the largest number, right? And so they said it never ends. And I said, well, how can it never end? So how can we use it if it never ends?
You're right. It's sort of like, you can't do it. It's impossible. And yet, there's something that in even imagining how much there's something about what you said about being just right there for your friends and going, you don't know how it's going to turn out. You can just keep opening and opening and opening and opening. And that's kind of the commitment. It's like you do that, but without like territory. It's like you're just opening and recognizing where you're bent, or you can be a benefit doing it as best you can, and just keep doing it. That's endless.
Yeah, and so I meditated every day.
Yeah,
and once or twice they would join me, but they always dropped off. Mm-hmm. So they just gave up. Well, one did it for one day, and so the next day. She said, well, that didn't work, did it? It was hilarious inside. I mean, I can control myself.
We're laughing for you.
I mean, what an answer. What kind of an answer could I make to that one?
But I think you raise a good point. This Bodhisattva vow is so outrageous. What we have to drop is our own sense of achievement.
Yeah.
We can't achieve it. And usually I'm a big goal setter, and there are just, enough, like 20 on my list, and I'll start crossing them off. But you just cannot achieve this. This is so enormous. To even contemplate it, like that was made me laugh, what you said about the number, like contemplating, where's the end? And
but the idea is if you think of it as a line, like all you can do is take the next step.
Right.
But what it says is after every step, there's another step.
Right. There's no end.
There's no end, but you just keep going because there's always more steps and not. But then you have to let go of the like. Mm-hmm. When have I taken all my steps for the day? Those are all the steps I got to take. I'm kind of a good person. Like I've been kind to three people today. Check.
Oh
gosh. But progress, even if you don't, you don't have to. It's the journey.
The journey.
And for me, just noticing, okay, I'm being kind or non-judgmental. whereas 5 years back I would have been. I feel like that's a good place for me to recognize, you know, that, okay, at least I've made this much, you know.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Because that's right. Progress.
Yeah, you can notice progress and celebrate that.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
beautiful.
Because, you know, just I'm kinder today than I was before. That's great.
You keep saying that. I can't imagine you're not kind.
I only know
you this way.
You're very kind. I was just thinking, you know, how, I don't know, I just sort of, sometimes you start looking at your own faults, and I was like,
really?
I should be nicer, you know? I really should be nicer. I said, I should be like Yasmin. Because you seem so, you're very available and open. And,
thank you.
And there's a receptivity there.
That's
sometimes
a very kind thing you're saying.
Who do you think you are?
Well, I feel like, well, maybe it's my lists and this driven quality. I feel so, you know, like achievement.
You haven't
oriented.
Checked everything off.
Yeah.
And every time you check it all off, then there's a new list.
Well, I look at this Bodhisattva vow and I think, what, who would ever sign up for that? It's really like impossible. But that's the whole point, you know, that, oh, that we're willing to step forward. That's it. We're not hiding behind the bridge, you know. We're really
that's
doing
the leap.
That's the leap.
That's the leap. Is no guarantees, but you're open. Yeah. Your heart's open. You see what's needed. You do what you can.
Yeah.
You leap. You put yourself out there. And she talks about every single one of us in this book. When she talks about parents being pushed to the edge with their children.
Yeah.
When she talks about caretakers, I'm thinking, there's Roberta. She's right in there.
Well, you know, the thing was, I was thinking it's so much easier with strangers. It's like with my family. Oh, my God. I'm going to kill them, you know? I mean, not my nieces and nephews, but my siblings. Oh, my Lord. You know, I could string them up. And, you know...
Please don't.
And, you know, it's just very different when it's so much less intense when people haven't hurt you in a personal way. You know, it's just, I don't know, or I don't feel hurt in a personal way, you know.
Well, there it is, isn't it? Right there, you know.
I feel totally with my family.
Totally what?
I fail totally.
You fail your what you imagine, who you imagine you should be, after all these years of meditating, and all these years of helping, being in the helping professions, and you fail with your family.
Yeah.
And then you realize you're not the only one.
That's right.
Who's done that?
But then it seems to me then there's the next step, like looking deeper. I mean, I think about this with my daughter, and, you know, it's like I have friends, I have a lot of people that like me, that I like. I seem very sociable and everything, and then I have this daughter who's like a complete stranger, and I don't even know how to talk to her. You know, and then I start to see that maybe I'm judging her in a certain way. So there's a kind of flip.
Well, I moved in.
Right. Right. There could be another thing go happening. But it's interesting. If there's a way to look at it a little differently, you know, I'm just saying, you know, there are many sides to the diamond, you know, and many faces and angles. So it's... And I started looking at it differently. And when I did that, I realized, oh, well, I haven't actually presented the things I really wanted to talk about. I can't expect her to guess what, you know, to make the opening. So it sort of flipped it for me. And then I think, oh, there's more possibility here than I thought, because I was just like, I was cutting it off by my own wall of, you know, why doesn't she ever ask me how I'm doing? You know, I mean, I already had some opinion about, you know, it's very, you know, it's so family, I think, is tough because there's a solidification in a history, you know, and the more we solidify, the less there is room for this heart-opening quality.
We think we know. We think we've pinned, every, pinned them down. And then we're not relating to them anymore. We're relating to
our story.
The story that we tell ourselves.
We're pinning ourselves down.
Yes.
Because it's actually our story that we're buying into and believing is real.
Right.
And so if you actually have someone close to you who's done some real harm, then, you know, actually, it's you who have to always begin the forgiving process.
Isn't that right? A bitch.
Because if we don't do that,
right,
then there's no possibility of actually meeting the other person.
I'm not very familiar with the because in the Theravada tradition, we begin our meditation with the meditation of compassion, right? We always begin with ourselves. There's no compassion that you can have for other people unless you have some for yourself and for the situation that you're in, whether it's difficulty with family or anybody. And the whole thing about, you know, it's some people say you can do the compassion for yourself for the rest of your life and still not get it. You know, like, yeah, so...
Well, you're absolutely right. And in this tradition, that's called Maitri, that sort of compassion for oneself. And you're... Have we not?
Well, the four immeasurables.
Yeah.
May all sentient beings enjoy happiness and the root of happiness. So,
but she's talking about...
Also, but we begin with, may I be well...
May I
self-compassion.
You begin with self-compassion. Always with yourself.
Right.
I think you're absolutely right. But what that's called, like, the other one is the Nurse Nancy effect. Like, I'm going to go help everybody. And that's like putting Band-Aids on everything. But you're still polluting with your own thoughts, your own energy. So you're right, yeah.
One of the things I found most offensive in hospitals was the people who saw themselves as the, oh, I'm a great helper. Spit at them, you know. Because you're here to be with this person. You're not here to be other and above.
You're right, but it's also those people are desperate for, all they're saying is, I feel like crap and I need this to feel good about myself.
And when I started in the hospital, it was so healing. I never had anything to offer anybody before. I'd walk into the room of these little old people and they'd say, oh, you're the little girl God sent to help me walk. Oh, thank you for coming. And it was so therapeutic for me. I mean, you know, it was healing.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. I never had anything to offer.
I wonder, you know, these three types of entry.
This is perfectly leading us to that, actually.
Yeah.
This is actually what she talks about in the three ways to enter this warrior path. The first is entering like a monarch, which we talked about in terms of, I've got to get all my shit together and then I'll be able to help people. And what's interesting, because she doesn't delegitimize that. Mm-hmm. She doesn't say, that's crazy, just get out there, you know. But she acknowledges that as a valid entry point. You're really working on yourself. You recognize when you're... when you're not fit for public consumption or but you're getting your self together. And the second one is the ferryman, that my pain will become a stepping stone. My pain will become a stepping stone. For understanding the pain of others, for opening to their suffering. And she says, whatever usually drags us down and causes us to retreat into ourselves is a stepping stone for awakening our compassion. So every time we go, I'm just going to stay under these blankets, it's like a little goad. But you can't do it. You can't hide out. So we're willing to just keep opening. She says this is the activity of the warrior. And then the shepherdess. And she said that the shepherd is always willing to put the flock before him or herself. And what does that mean? This is one that I would like to talk about, actually, because this could be really tricky. Did anybody have any thoughts about this in reading it?
Well, as you're saying that, what I realized, which I never thought of before, that the monarch, in a way, that's sort of the Hinayana path.
Clearly,
I mean,
yes.
Here we are in the three, and here's another version of
Hinayana,
you know, taking care of, you know, you're getting your own stuff together, and the Mahayana is more like the ferryman, taking everybody with you and helping them move along. And the shepherd, I don't know, it doesn't quite line up exactly, but it's sort of a sense of a much bigger vision. And
I'm always
think,
willing
yeah,
to put.
I think of emptiness.
Yes.
You're in the openness of the sky.
Yeah.
But isn't that also just sort of the basic vow that you're, you know, everybody else's enlightenment comes before yours? I mean, you're not going to.
Well, you're not concerned about your enlightenment at that point,
right.
Which is actually
right.
definitely
that
equivalent
is.
To.
That isn't that what
well, you know, the way Trungpa Rinpoche put it, actually, he put it in the second commitment dimension. He said, basically, others are more important than you are, and once you take the bodhisattva vow, you no longer are concerned about your own enlightenment. I mean, in other words, that's not the fundamental question, because that was a Hinayana thing, right? We're looking at how can I get out of this, how can I transcend, how can I do this and that. And he says, basically, I mean, so obviously when he says this, it's pretty ripened state, but it is definitely in the context of the
pretty what state? Ripened.
Ripened.
Right.
Yeah, to where there's just no longer any concern about where you're, mm-hmm. what you're going to get out of this. Unlike the ferryman, who's happy to bring everybody along with them, but mm-hmm. ferryman knows where they're going, you know.
Right.
So in this case, there's no kind of goal here for oneself.
Right.
You're just addressing the situation.
So enlightenment itself becomes moot. Right.
Well,
I mean,
yeah,
like the
I mean,
search
the way
it's
discussed from the way we discuss it, and when we talk about the kayas, you know, which is like a pretty exalted way of discussing the whole process of being, is that the compassion is basically just natural response. It's just the most natural, spontaneous response to a situation, any situation, anywhere, anytime, and that just where you're no longer, there's no reference point about me at all at that point. So, yeah, you could say that's definitely more exalted kind of.
But that's why it's so hard with family, because we have this previous story that blocks us, right? Yeah, you know how what this person is and what they're going to do and how they're going to react and the trouble you've had before. And it's solidified already.
Well, except that actually, because I also have a family. And you discover also that there are ways of actually working with that very kind of story or solidification. That's actually the key to open the whole door to discovering, well, wait a minute, I mean, we're just here, you know?
Right.
And it's just now. And, I mean, all that other stuff, it's like anything else. I remember just a personal example of being really turned off. I lived in Germany when I was in the army, you know, and I learned German, and so I could hold conversations with people, and I was always trying to avoid being pegged by as an American, so I tried to let my hair grow long. And you know. I mean, there were ways that, like, you never put your hands in your pants. That was like definitely a late. Yeah, you were just being pegged immediately. And so I'd meet Germans and often start talking to them, and they not one person ever told me who was an older person who was alive during the war and during the Nazi era that I had never participated in this. I mean, I didn't know a thing about it. At a certain point, you know, you start going, wait a minute. It's not like nobody knew about anything, right? So I got really turned off. And then I saw this movie, The Triumph of the Will, by Leni Riefenstahl, which was a fantastic, very interesting film about Hitler coming into Nuremberg, where I lived for 3 years. And I was just like, and I saw people in that film who looked familiar. I mean, you know, the film was 30 years before. I really got shocked. And I said, I can't speak German anymore. I just quit. I just completely turned off. And, you know, I mean, it was like, I just felt like, because I just was so disgusted, even though I knew that the people who I knew personally in Germany, who were my age, it wasn't their fault, but they bore this. And the problem was nobody knew how to deal with it.
So you said every person who spoke to you said, I knew we all knew nothing about it?
Older people. Yeah, I mean, you know, kids didn't know, they couldn't say anything. I mean, what are they going to do? My parents were Nazis, you know. I mean, you know, it's more about my attitude toward the whole thing. So then I went back again after, I guess it was 25 years, and it was suddenly I realized, wait a minute, I have to just get over this. Mm-hmm. I just have to overcome. And I began to realize as I just opened up and just dropped it, that people were opening up to me, which was, I didn't really experience that before.
When did you go back?
This was around 19, early 90s.
You were part of your history, too, because back in your first time, they weren't dealing with it either.
Right, they weren't.
I mean, the whole world.
Well, I think, you know, here I am, once they realize, or if they figure out I'm an American, because they start trying to figure out you said like this, you know, you must be an army, you know, that's what they call Americans. Then they pegged you, boom, you're right there. So they weren't going to say anything about, you know, but I saw collectively what they really did as well, which was particularly in the 90s and for the last 20 years. I mean, they really went through it. They really said, hey, wait a minute, we just have to own up to our history and we have to learn from it. And I became extraordinarily, because that was my inner attitude when I started, when I first came to Germany. I want to believe these people are good, you know, that they, even if they did things like this collectively, that fundamentally that. But I just had reached a point of steeling myself against what I just felt like was their inability to accept their own horror. And I mean, same thing with Hungarians. So I got into Hungarians and Hungarian language for 35 years. And, you know, look what they're doing now. I mean, they're turning into a complete fascist state. And people are just frightened. They don't know what to do. This is the problem about... And so, you know, I mean, I'm just speaking now how I was approaching collectively. But it turns into an individual circumstance where you meet somebody, and then if you really open up, and you really open up and you're just willing to let go of all of this storyline I'm carrying, you know, that person opens up. And you discover, in the midst of all that, there's warmth and common
that's
warmth.
The really weirdest important. Thing. I had a mailman. We just had the greatest relationship, and he was just friendly as hell. I was friendly as hell with him. And he felt so comfortable enough with me to tell me that the Jews were taking over. It was their fault. And he was just like the friendliest guy, and I went, that's me you're talking about.
Wow.
And it was a shocker.
To him.
It was to for me to hear him say that, and then for me to say that to him, it was like, there was like this gap of like first there was just a gap, and then there was, what do we do now?
Wow.
You know, it was like, because the whole thing was solidified.
Right. So what happened?
What happened? He stopped being my mailman.
How did he manage?
I don't know.
Did she just get put on a...
I have no idea. Wow. But he was... maybe
God made himself scarce.
So maybe he decided to.
He made himself scarce, so he
went. You know, but he may have said that to enough people that he maybe isn't anybody's mailman anymore.
Right, that's true too.
I don't think Newton's the place.
The Jews.
Probably like he probably said that to 50 people, and 28 of them said that's me. The other 22 just didn't bother.
There was a guy with a swastika working at the Apple store in Chestnut Hill.
What?
A couple of years back. A couple of years back.
That's really
and I saw it, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't say to him or to anybody, because then I felt all of a sudden vulnerable, because they knew who I was and all that.
You're identifying yourself.
Because they knew your phone and they could change your phone.
Everything, but he does raise the issue of how what does leaping really mean?
Right.
Like, you can open, but it doesn't mean you're always going to find a really nice landing pad, or any landing pad.
You may not. You know, it doesn't. There's no guarantee that suddenly it's all going to turn out nice. I mean, I have friends in the Czech Republic where I was, and you know, when people meet who are on this other level where they're not sharing, I mean, for instance, the Germans wouldn't do this. They wouldn't tell you that. They wouldn't be openly anti-Semitic if they had problems like that. But if they're not German, they feel easier about it. You know, like, Jews are just, like, I mean, look, I mean, this one guy who I was working with, actually, I liked him very much. He was a very sweet guy who spent 30 years in this country. He had a very difficult time growing up and, you know, the dissident. And, you know, I mean, but he just going around carrying this anti-Semitism. And I said, I don't know how you can go on like this. You know, most of your clients, for one thing, he sells photography and rare books. And I said, most of your clients are Jews. Do you realize that when you come to this country and you get put up at somebody's house, they're Jews? How about that? What's that mean? You know, what kind of rhetoric can you sustain like this when, in fact, you're depending on these people for your livelihood? You know, I mean,
what was his reaction?
He just shrugged his shoulders. It was like he couldn't
register.
No, because he's using this as a means for working out some other kind of sense of grievance that he can't do otherwise.
Yes.
And I think one of the reasons Jews are our target is because they are different. If I make them different, then at least I've got them something out there.
My identity versus that.
Exactly. And so I can't go against or deal with the problems of my society, who are primarily, you know, whatever you want to call it, traditional WASP or whatever they are in Czech. They're basically Catholics or Protestants, but I mean, they're basically Czechs, you know. And so, you know, they're all anti-German as well, because they got occupied too.
Well, that's...
So there's understanding where people are coming from and why they're doing it, and then just to take it out of sort of, and then there's where you want to take your business. So to take it out of the Jewish anti-Semitic thing, it's just to think in a neutral way. So in Newton, for instance, where I live, like, there are a lot of doctors, there are a lot of lawyers, and a lot of them are competent. If I, you know, go to a doctor and I just think they're a jerk, I don't like how they treat me, I don't like how they treat other people, I go to someone else because I have a choice. So I think that one can understand, this is obviously my opinion, but one can understand why somebody is a jerk or an awful person.
And still not.
But then it is a decision which you can make or not, but I certainly always make it, is like, F you, you know, you're not gonna get my business, you're not gonna get my sympathy for your distorted stuff that's hurting people. So I have to say that.
But I have one point to it. So, you know, there's a friend of mine that was in 3-year retreat, and he just every once in a while, I don't talk to him very often, but he's extremely negative. And he's always negative. It doesn't matter what it is. And I think I'm just sort of like a dish rag, and I just listen to him, and then I hang up, and I don't hear from him for another 6 months, and so what? But then I'm thinking, well, why don't you say something, Emily? You know, why do you just let him go on with all this negativity? Because...
Does it affect you?
You know,
it really does.
It is... I feel like, is there some responsibility I have to wake this guy up? Yeah. I mean, he did the 3-year retreat and he acts like a jerk, you know? I mean, it's...
Well, what does that say? Because you did a 3-year retreat doesn't mean
anything.
Well, family.
No,
well,
I mean,
I don't
know. Maybe you know if he's that solid.
Oh, man.
That, you know, or maybe you feel, well, maybe you'll call back sometime and it'll be different because... If I tell him now, that'll be the end of it.
I have actually hung up on somebody because he was
going on and on. What?
I've actually hung up on somebody because he was going on and on and on. And it was like, thunk.
Well, you do. I mean, psychology, you are reinforcing that behavior.
Because I'm not listening.
People assume if you're listening, then
you're agreeing.
Somehow it's either
what he's doing is okay.
It's acceptable.
That's
so
helpful.
If you don't want to encourage it, so you just know what you're doing is encouraging it.
Okay.
And then it's up to you whether you want to encourage it.
Good. Thank you.
We always say that.
You did throw out somebody.
You
threw somebody out who was visiting you because he's a fellow Dharma brother who basically was just bad mouthing everybody. He told me from the house when he came over. You can't do that.
Yeah.
But I think he wasn't a 3-year retreat. You know, there's something about the bond.
Yeah.
I'm just recognizing he must have seen enough that I can't just sort of, you know, I mean, it's often complicated. That's another kind of family.
It's complicated.
Just so a different kind of family. It's not blood family.
Right.
But it's like you share something so profound.
Right.
It's not just like, oh, blow off, man, you know, because I don't like what you're saying.
Right.
Does he listen to the recordings we make?
Right. I'm just thinking.
Probably
want to be really careful.
Well, this is
being
this
good.
Is
thank you.
Domain, right?
This is very good.
It's good. It's true.
We're after
it. Okay, let's
time to finish.
Time to.